Today's episode of Pulse Check is presented by Pfizer Rx Pathways. Get the help you need to get the Pfizer prescriptions you need. Find your path at PfizerRxPathways.com.
I wanted my own voice. I was very interested in ideas and policy more than the politics. And I was interested in what shapes how the public thinks along the way, because more and more I could see from inside Washington, that really was what governed what happened inside Washington.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Atul Gawande, the surgeon and author, reminiscing about his time in Washington, D.C. If you listen to Pulse Check, I have to think you know who Atul is. But if you don't, he's the best-selling author of Being Mortal. He's the popular writer who appears in The New Yorker, and in his spare time, somehow, he's a practicing physician in Massachusetts who also leads two nonprofits. He's someone that I've wanted to have on this podcast since day one. We talked about his writing process, his path to Capitol Hill and then on to med school, and how he's grappling with some of the biggest health policy questions. And stick around until the end of our conversation, where we'll answer some listener questions. You can find time cues in the show notes. Just a reminder, if you like Pulse Check, you can find us on your favorite podcast player and recommend us and rate us. You can find me at ddiamond at politico.com or at ddiamond on Twitter with feedback and suggestions. You can also find me speaking at Yale University, where I'm a pointer fellow this week. And if you like this conversation with Atul, you might enjoy my recent interview with Aaron Carroll, another doctor and writer. I also had a great chat with Mandy Cohen, the North Carolina HHS secretary, a few weeks ago too. So check both of those out in our archives. And with that, here's Atul Gawande. I just saw you give a talk at the New Yorker Festival. You're doing this podcast. You run Face the Nation. You're a surgeon. You're a writer. You run a research lab. Presumably you have family and friends that you'd like to see. Is there a cost-benefit analysis for how you spend your time?
Yes. I mean, I'm very meticulous about it. In fact, I keep a chart that my executive assistant keeps, and there are four metrics. Do you want to hear the metrics?
I think we'd all like to hear the metrics.
So the metrics are, I like to have 25% unscheduled time, and I can't always, I usually don't get it, but we chart whether I'm able to hit it and whether I come close, at least. Second is how many nights I'm in my own bed at home and need that to be at least half of the nights in the month. Once you add in travel and call and other things like that. It's, and then I need to be about 40% of the days, at least 4 hours in our office where I run our public health research center. And then the final one is how many hours of writing per month? And I like to get in at least an hour a day on average. So can I get 30 hours a month? And I'm miserable when I'm below 30 hours. And when I'm above 30 hours, I'm a really happy person. I maximize against those.
Which one of those metrics is the most important to preserve? You just mentioned writing and being miserable if you come below that threshold. What about nights that you're home or unstructured time?
The lagging indicator is writing. So I don't feel like I can do my writing unless I'm sort of everything else is satisfied. Like I'm getting the work I'm supposed to be doing done. I'm seeing my family. I'm, a decent amount of sleep. And then I feel like I can get in the mental space where I can write. I can't write if, you know, we now have almost 100 people in my research center. And I, you know,
Ariadne
Labs, yes. I sort of feel like I'm only as happy as my unhappiest child in the family. And in a similar way, if there's unhappiness in the workplace, I can't write. I've got to think about that. Like, that's on my brain.
Did you switch to the system as a result of something you learned in your research? Has this always been the way for you that you've had some sort of tracker of what
no,
you need
that's,
to do?
No, that's a new thing. where did I get that?
Is this your next book? The Calendar Manifesto?
No. I think I got it from a couple things. One is that everybody tells you you're supposed to have a dashboard for, you know, running an organization or doing any of that kind of stuff. And I found, you know, I need that kind of way of seeing above the horizon. And so I found that really helpful. And then it was actually weirdly, I think, in combination with Rivers Cuomo of the band Weezer, who is also extremely meticulous about how everything he does in his band, including how many. So he tracks how many nights he's away on tour and how many with his wife and kids when they join him. Those are bonus days on tour. He'll do extra days on tour if they come with him. And I was like, boy, that makes a ton of sense. What if I did a dashboard for my life? And then that's worked out really well.
We've been doing this podcast for nearly 2 years. I think this is the first time a rock star has been cited as a reference point for evidence-based decision. Thinking about where you are spending that time, you are now talking again about your book, Being Mortal, came out 3 years ago to the day nearly, a book about how the healthcare system deals with end-of-life decisions. Since your book came out, which helped jumpstart discussion around end-of-life care, how do you think the healthcare system has improved in dealing with those challenges?
Well, the first thing was when it came out, we were still in a political debate about whether it was death panels to have discussions and encourage discussions about people's goals for their end-of-life care and for facing life-limiting illness.
You're talking about the slur that was attached to the Affordable Care Act around just having conversations.
That's right. The whole idea of compensating clinicians, let alone encouraging and saying this should be the normal way that we all in society sort of that we all have a discussion about what our priorities are besides just living longer and then try to align the care around what matters to you besides just survival. And so the book was an effort to push back against that cultural place we'd come to in that political place, but also to grapple with the anxiety of that not only turns up in policy, but also just in the daily lives of clinicians and patients and families about dealing with the reality that we are mortal and how you deal with the fact that we all come to an end and have to make decisions in those circumstances. So the second thing I think that's happened is that that I think is awesome, and I don't think I'm the only one that's been driving this by any means, is the recognition that the reason why it's not a death panel is this is not about whether the fundamental question is not whether you want to fight or you want to give up. The fundamental question is, what do you want to fight for? What are you willing to sacrifice and what are you not willing to sacrifice for the sake of more time? What's the minimum quality of life you'd find acceptable? What are your goals if time is short? And asking people those questions turns out to be a way of giving them control. And in fact, the fact that we do not ask those questions causes so much suffering that you know, we have a lot of evidence, which people were very skeptical about early on. So I didn't know how the book would be received. I deliberately started the book tour in Topeka, Kansas, where, you know, was a center of a lot of anger and debate around whether this kind of stuff is death panels, and found that within 10 minutes, people were talking about their grandmother and their grandfather and what happened to them when they saw them come to the end of their life and how that's not what they wanted for themselves. And they thought that the health system had failed people. Now, have we advanced farther than that? We did a survey in the state of Massachusetts. So on my research hat, I run a coalition where we've been doing surveys now on an annual basis. This is our third year we'll be running the survey. And we found that less than 15% of the population had a conversation with their clinician about their goals for their care at the end of life, including only a quarter of people who had a serious illness with a hospitalization in the last year. Over 90% felt that we should be having these conversations, and that minority who did have the conversation had a radically better experience in their care, more satisfaction with their care as they came to the end of life than the people who didn't. So this discussion has started. The systems are not there.
So when thinking about how much progress has been made in the past 3 years, incremental progress, a fair amount of progress?
It's sort of like ACOs in the sense that...
So there's a lot of hype and not actually much has changed?
Right. I would put it this way. There are a lot of great pilots and demonstrations that haven't scaled. So, you know, we rolled out a program at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute that got it so that over 90% of people end up having these conversations before they come to the end of life. They occur at 5 months instead of just the last few weeks before the end of life. We're seeing marked reductions in suffering, including anxiety and depression. People feel better. They don't live shorter. They live longer, if anything. And that's preliminary data, by the way. We're still going through it. But we're seeing other places. We launched with Baylor Scott & White, the largest health system in Texas. You see it out at some of the places you expect. Kaiser and is another place that's had a strong palliative care skill initiative for so that everybody knows how to have these conversations. But we are still in pockets, and we're not the only ones who are doing these projects, but it's the minority. That said, we're up to 50% of the population now comes to the end of life with hospice and not in the hospital kind of setting. And that's a radical change. In fact, it's the highest level in the world. So the idea that the U.S. is behind in some way, actually, I don't think is true.
You had plenty of fans in the last administration. President Obama assigned the cost conundrum as required reading. Jon Favreau, his speechwriter, who was on this podcast, said that Obama would name drop you. My understanding is that you and Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, the former HHS secretary, go back decades. What has your communication been like with this administration? Have you had any meaningful interaction with the Trump team?
Well, you know, the funny thing is I had virtually no meaningful interaction with the Obama administration or this administration. I hardly we're in Washington doing this podcast. I hardly come to Washington. I come to Washington for nonprofit stuff I do, and the reason why is because I don't think the story is in Washington. Like I was doing the story about McAllen, Texas being the most expensive place for Medicare in the United States, right? And that required no time talking to people in Washington. And the reason why is I feel like Washington follows the public and where the public, what the public experience of care is and the public experience of costs really is. The fundamental responsibility is partly policy, but heavily how we in healthcare run the damn system and do it in ways that are damaging and do it ways that are incredibly beneficial. And so, you know, I sort of feel like I've got everything outside the beltway almost to myself, which is crazy. Like, you know, I could spend a year and a half investigating why is the most expensive community for healthcare in the country so expensive, and know that there would not be a single other reporter who would scoop me. And
I feel like you're identifying a clear market opportunity in journalism, though. I mean, this is known that there are hubs in New York, in Washington, and California. And then there just aren't enough reporters chasing stories in the middle of the country.
That's right. And that's all I do. Like, you know, this last piece is healthcare. Right? I mean, I didn't go to Washington for that. I went home and I talked to people and asked moral questions. And then the fact that it turns out to be influential, so the administration, I didn't get any calls. But
recent story you
made. Yeah, over the last, I've written three, four pieces this year about primary care and, you know, where things are going out in the real world. And it's led to more than a dozen Republican senators spending time with me, similar number of the Democrats, asking questions, wanting to understand what I was writing about. Same response to this article on healthcare as a right.
Who is the most thoughtful Republican senator on healthcare?
Well, so I'm not going to name names because they asked me not to. But what I would say is that there is a lot more thoughtfulness than you hear out in the public. And part of the interesting thing to me is that there's a different view about what the job is of a Democrat versus a Republican. So with the Democrats, it's often that the discussion's all about what's the policy I want to go for and how do I get the public there? And with many of the Republican politicians I spoke to, it was, well, I'm really interested in this, and this is what I think, but that's not what my constituency thinks, and I'm a representative, and this is my voting group, and this is where I'm going, and I have to find a way to be there, or I'm not representing them, and I'm out of office anyway. So, you know, as one said to me, you know, that's fine, but everybody running against me is to the right of Attila the Hun, and so that's not a direction I can go. And so, you know, you have meaningful conversations, but different people are attacking to different places. My, you know, there are many ways to look at that. It's information for me, and fruitful to know at least what people voice is where they're coming from.
Well, this makes me wonder about your strategy, where the last administration, Democrats, more receptive to the policy ideas, this administration, or at least the folks who are influential in Washington right now, somewhat different in how they approach healthcare issues. Has that changed your communication strategy, whether on Twitter, on TV? I saw you on Face the Nation with John Dickerson a few weeks ago. Was that a deliberate choice, knowing that the Sunday shows are an effective way to reach this administration now?
Oh, I mean, I happily went on Sunday shows whenever I have the opportunity and someone wants to have me there, because it's usually because I've written something and then I can try to amplify it, and that's great. But you know, I do my best to call it as I see it, and the main way I'm trying to do both my public health research and my investigative reporting is by thinking about what is required to improve people's lives. Like, how does healthcare save lives and how does it not? And I've had a practice where, as a cancer surgeon, I had 10% of my patients uninsured. There's no conceivable circumstance under which that is a good idea for people's health or well-being. And so when you talk to conservatives or liberals, I rarely have a conversation. It's only the extreme libertarians I have a conversation where they say, who cares? You know, so what if, you know, the market is what the market is, and you know, it's Ayn Rand and you know, the fittest survive and screw the rest.
You've been talking to Mike Lee and Ted Cruz, haven't you? You've just given it away despite your promise to keep it behind closed doors.
I rarely have that line of conversation with anybody in inside or outside politics. Because what people, that was what was the heartening thing to me about going back home, is at the end of the day, people still hold it as a core value, this medical value that I was trained in and raised with, but also a Declaration of Independence value, which is that all are created equal, that all of us have lives of equal worth and dignity that we deserve, and that we need, and that our policies need to close the gap between that aspiration and reality, and instead our policies are making it worse. And so, you know, I just keep trying to mine that core vein.
A lesser-known chapter about your career was your time in Washington, not recently talking to senators, but as a younger person, before you were 50, but as a congressional staffer for Al Gore, I believe. And
I was a unpaid intern when Al Gore ran for president in 1988, and no one remembers this, but he had to get out of that race because he admitted to smoking pot. So 1988, he couldn't become, he had to drop out, and so I was an intern all of 2 months on that campaign, and then
the Overton window on what we permit in our public leaders is amazing when you think about it. I mean, Tom Daschle couldn't get confirmed as HHS secretary for these like minor indiscretions in comparison to what our leaders.
That's right. What was it like having a limousine driver or something? Like there was
there was a serious tax issue of things that income wasn't paid.
Yes. The Overton window. We've defined deviancy upward as who was it? The senator Pat Moynihan would have said, but Daniel Pat Moynihan. Now you like knocked me off course. So where were we?
You were the unpaid intern for the Al Gore campaign. Right. You worked for Representative Jim Cooper, the Tennessee Democrat.
That's right. So I worked for what I was interested in was these Southern politicians who went and got their Ivy League education and then went home to constituencies that were more conservative than they were and then won. And won with big margins in their offices. So I ended up working for Jim Cooper, who was in Eastern Tennessee with one of the most conservative districts and would win with 65% of the vote every time. Al Gore, who would win over and over again while focusing on issues like cable and environment, and then and SALT II back then, a disarmament treaty, and then you had Bill Clinton, who I ended up working for.
Won right. Several times.
He did. And he lost when he first started running.
That's true.
As governor. And so I was interested in people who could carry on that dialogue and manage to – I didn't find any secrets. I never did figure out, like, what do these people have in common?
Other than being Ivy League educated and
– and went home and stuck it out and had the dialogue.
What do you know now about how Washington works – that maybe you didn't realize when you were in your 20s? Is there some benefit of hindsight or wisdom that now you see how this town fits together? Or was it the right decision to only spend a few years here and then leave as soon as possible for medical school?
I think those are two separate questions, right? So one is, what did I learn? And then was the right decision? The right decision because it was personal. And it's sort of related to what I learned. What I learned was, number one, being right about policy is not all that matters. And so I, you know, just wanted to have the right analysis and figure it out. And then when people wouldn't do that, it would sort of be infuriating. Like, how could you not, you know, do this? And why do these extraneous things like there would be often unpleasant, right? So I'm now working in the Clinton administration. It's the early days. It's healthcare reform. I'm only 26 years old. I've got the task force on benefit design and finance.
And if I'm doing my job as moderator, I should clarify, you were the architect of his plan during his campaign in 1992, right? His healthcare plan that came.
I was
from
the facilitator. So one of the roles of a campaign policy guy. So I was in charge of policy for domestic social policy, so healthcare, welfare, Social Security, things like that, research, and which meant I was the incoming traffic controller for all the different views, and then trying to turn it into ways that he can make decisions about what he wanted to say and what he didn't want to say and do, and learned a ton doing that. It was incredibly fun as well. It's always fun to win, but the entering into the job where now it was a kind of a chaotic process, and then discovering that, you know, I'd run briefings in the Roosevelt. I get to, you know, do the briefing in the Roosevelt room and then have people who wanted me out of there leak to the press XYZ, you know, he's just a medical student doing the briefing, or other stuff along the way. They're not only, I'd no longer be running the briefing, I'd be kicked out of the briefing. One of the things I learned was, so Sylvia Burwell and I were students together at Oxford, where we were both in school. And
we were both Rhodes Scholars, to be
right,
clear.
Right. And
just hang out in Oxford with Sylvia Matthews
right.
Burwell.
And she understood there were ups and downs. And she stuck it out the whole way. And I did not and you know, over time she found ways to be effective. She became deputy chief of staff in the White House, eventually OMB director, eventually head, you know, Secretary of Health and Human Services. And I needed to learn how to have that kind of patience. I think the second thing, though, was I was not ready to do what she did, which is to have my future dependent on the careers of politicians. I wanted my own voice. I was very interested in ideas and policy more than the politics. And I was interested in what shapes how the public thinks along the way, because more and more I could see from inside Washington, that really was what governed what happened inside Washington, is people were driven by what was happening at home. The president does have an unusual bully pulpit. Nobody else does. And events on the ground are what drive things much more. And I became much more interested in how that dialogue was shaped and where could I make any little contribution along the way. And so I went back to medical school, and my supposition was that discussions about healthcare reform would be dead for a decade. It was more like a decade and a half, which gave me time to, you know, find all the things I loved from being in medicine, becoming a surgeon, and doing other things like that.
And then you were in position when that debate came back up to play a role in your writing.
Yeah, it was unexpected. I was not a good writer. I never did well in writing when I was in school. I had my worst grade in that in those classes. But when I was halfway through my surgical training and a friend started Slate magazine, and nobody would write for Slate magazine in 1996.
Jacob Weisberg, I'm assuming.
Jacob Weisberg, yep. And he, as he started it with Michael Kinsley, you know, it was Netscape Navigator days. You'd get 300 hits for an article. What journalist wants to switch from, you know, hundreds of thousands of readers to 300 hits, mostly your family? And but I'd never done anything like that. And Jacob's asked his friends, would you write stuff? And I said, sure. It was a way to stay connected to these kinds of discussions when I was in the middle of my training.
Hey, it's Dan Diamond. And we'll get back to our conversation with Atul Gawande in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Today's episode of Pulse Check is presented by Pfizer Rx Pathways. If you're underinsured or uninsured, getting affordable Pfizer medicines can be a daunting road. Find a simpler path at PfizerRxPathways.com.
Before we go barreling down on your writing path, which Lord knows I have questions about, just parking for a second on your Washington experience, you were on the Hill, you were in HHS for some time. Would you ever want to come back now that you've had this wealth of other experience that you could draw on?
It's always a temptation, and I've been asked at various points. But what I learned out of the writing is that what I'm good at is not the same as what people who are good at leading agencies or running for office are really good at. People who run for office, like Bill Clinton, loved a good fight. He loved a good enemy. I hate a fight. I hate people who hate me. I hate being hated. You know, like I don't draw energy on any of that stuff. Like it doesn't. It just gets me down. And so, you know, you have to have not just a thick skin. You have to find some joy in the battle, and so that is a problem. And then second, in office, you know, like I'm really, my strength is in ideas. My strength is in trying to think about, you know, what's the goal here and what are we getting at along the way and trying to figure out what the priorities need to be. Being a great administrator is as much about how do you navigate bureaucracies and manage the effectiveness of this institution and know, you know, that LBJ skill of how do you know what that congressman needs and this congressman needs. And, you know, I'm slowly getting better at that sort of thing, but that's not my, I would work really hard and be like an A- at that. Whereas if I can leave behind a series of things that help reshape how we think about what happens at the end of your life and what we really think about healthcare, right? Or, you know, where we're going with costs or, you know,
That's your comparative advantage is what I'm
hearing. Yeah, that's my A. That's my shot as long as I can do that.
And I'm not hearing a declaration of candidacy for HHS secretary, even though the job is open right now.
You're right.
Let's wrap our conversation by talking about your writing path. And we've already talked about the cost conundrum, which in my opinion is the greatest health policy article written in my adult lifetime. There was the Checklist Manifesto, which changed practice and hospitals. Being Mortal, we've talked about as well, that impact. Hellhole, which had a long-running impact on how people think
which
about...
Which is to say no impact at the beginning about solitary confinement, but then slowly emerging.
I'm curious how you come to your ideas. So the cost conundrum makes sense. Being Mortal makes sense. Even Hellhole, I can understand if that's something that might have been germinating for a while. You have to be getting pitched by so many different public health advocates and researchers. You have your own interests. How do you figure out what's in the sweet spot for a New Yorker magazine piece?
I pretty much ignore all the pitches that come my way. I don't. Instead, I keep a running list on my phone. I've kept it for a long time of ideas that I have. Let's see. I can open it up. I'm up to number...
I may yank that phone away from you.
Can't touch it. And let's see. Ideas are up to idea number 383. And
these are 383 unwritten ideas?
Unwritten ideas. I mean, some of them I might have written. 90% of them are bad, but I will scribble them down as I go along. And they often come out of a sense of confusion or distress. Like,
something will happen at work, or I'll see something in the news, and I'll write down, like, what is that about? And it might be, you know, why are the costs so high, or what is up with this death panel stuff, and why do I have such a hard time in these kinds of conversations? Or you know, scribble down, and there was what is itching? And, you know, eventually came across the case of a woman who had an itch that was so terrible she scratched through her own skull and injured her own brain. And, you know, that's just a great story that you get to tell and dig into. And then, you know, it leads to questions about consciousness and so on. The 5 or 10% of them have the opportunity to dig in. And it only comes together when I feel like the search for an answer will not only reveal something that could be interesting in the ideas, but that I've also got a story that makes it real in the world. Sometimes I'll see the story that makes something real, but not understand what the debate is that makes it worthwhile. Because what is itching started with that case, and that was like, as soon as I had read that case in a journal and then thought about what is itching, I knew that was a story that was ready to happen because I had both the pieces, right? There was a big question and there was a really, really tough case. And that's the thing that has to come together. And they can sit in there on my phone for ages before all the pieces come together.
Well, if they're sitting in your phone for ages, have there been great story ideas that you feel like you've missed because you weren't able to move on them and assemble all the pieces in time?
Lots of them. Yeah, mainly because I can't write all of these, and I think that it's crazy that I am the only one. I'm not the only one, but that
you're moving on a different cycle than many daily reporters who are tracking the health policy debate in D.C. and it's hard to escape to Topeka, Kansas, or Texas, or what have you.
That's right, but it is like I really avoid. I can't compete with you at what you do. I'm not going to be able, and I don't know why all the other people try to compete with you or what you do. You know, there's like the different people who are chasing what is the next bill that drops, or what is the administration doing this week to try to repeal the ACA without Congress. That's worth following, but there's a whole lot of, it feels like third grade soccer. Everybody is swarming the ball, and you know, I'm over here playing defense, thinking about, which is a luxury. I admit, I get to think about where's things likely to be two or three or four passes along the way, and spend slow amounts of time getting there. But that's because I only can write 25,000 words a year, and I put out just three articles. And there ought to be more competition, I think, in that space.
I think one reason we swarm the ball is because the influence economy and the DC political economy is their jobs dependent on who is first to know about a bill or where does Senator X sit on some provision.
But think about the economy here. Like another person that I hugely admire, in fact, if I could write at that level, it'd be amazing, is Michael Lewis, right? So Michael Lewis is looking at what is the story of this finance world and where value is really coming from. And, you know, you can figure out the formula of what he's doing. He does it uncommonly well, but it's not like you couldn't predict where the next big stories are any better than he is.
Though he's now focusing on Washington, D.C., which I feel like will be, he'll do it even better than us, but he's looking at the administration and the ways that it is not prepared for the challenges that await it.
Yeah, but look at the piece he'd done about what was it? It was the Energy Department and what moving into the Energy Department looked like from the perspective of just a common bureaucrat trying to make all the important things like protecting our nuclear waste disposal system and how the nuclear weapons that are being transported and stored all over the country are being managed, and how nobody, as they came in, was asking anything relevant to what was happening there, and that the bureaucrats just had to manage themselves to this day seemingly with no oversight, right? And the idea that he just was looking a few moves down the road and saying, what is this government for and how is it doing? And then making that where he went. And so I those are the people that inspire me, and I feel like are and they make plenty of a good living. Like it's hard for me to see that it's an economic problem.
I was going to ask, you provoke, inspire in your writing. Is Michael Lewis and that cohort of writers that you turn to for similar?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. He.
Who else?
Well, I mean, it's I'd say the most inspiring one to me right now is Svetlana Alexievich, the journalist who won the Nobel Prize now 3 years ago. A Belarusian who's been reporting from inside Russia just by going and talking to people about the stuff that Putin and his administration doesn't want anybody to talk about. Like, in an earlier era, what was happening in the Afghan war, which people weren't acknowledging was underway, or what happened at Chernobyl. She lost part of her family at Chernobyl. She wrote an amazing book called Voices of Chernobyl. You know, she's the first to win the Nobel Prize writing nonfiction since Solzhenitsyn, and doing with extraordinary bravery and with this incredible voice where she is just giving literally oral histories that she's curated, interviews hundreds of people. There's no other narrative. It is just the voices of people. And it's like a radio. One reviewer said it's like a radio of the Russian experience, and I think there, at the highest level, I would get to something like that.
Some would say that you're already there. My last question: you mentioned that incredible year with Hellhole, Cost Conundrum, the piece that became Being Mortal. Do you feel like your best days as a writer are still in front of you? Have you reached a peak that you're going to be at for the next 30 years?
God, I ask that all the, like, every time a piece ends, like, oh, what am I, like, how do I try it again? Because
you just cut and paste from one of your Slate articles that people haven't looked at in 20 years.
The hard part about writing is you're trying to make it new every time. Like, the thing about surgery, I'm trying to make it the same every time, and I can get faster and more adept. Whereas in writing, you're trying to make it so it's fresh for people and that you want to approach it. And people, as soon as they feel like you're doing the same thing, I'm using up moves along the way here, and I have to find new moves I can make. I felt like I discovered one even in this piece on healthcare, on is healthcare right? Because so much of my writing is out of my own voice and an interplay between my medical experience and the policy and other people's experiences doing that. And this one was much more, I didn't have to be a doctor to write that. In fact, I don't think I had any real personal medical experiences in there. It was more just what I needed was just to be growing up in Ohio and thinking about something like the moral question of whether healthcare is right.
Are you sure, though, that people want to see something new? I mean, you mentioned Michael Lewis, and you can feel the through line in his books, and Malcolm Gladwell obviously has a certain formula he uses. I would say, as someone who's read 95% of what you've written, I can see the connective tissue between that. So it's new in that there's a new idea, but the formula, and I mean this with praise, the formula is something familiar, which as a reader can be something to look forward to.
Well, there's style and there's formula. So if I'm doing it right, I'm connecting you to the telescope and the microscope, and you're seeing how experience, whether of healthcare or other kinds of or science or what happens in our bodies, you see it up close and then you see it from afar, and I'm navigating you through that way. But if I opened every piece with, he was rushed into the emergency room. It was three after, it was three in the morning. He was dying on the bed. You would become really conscious of that, and it would throw you out of being. I want you to just come in and feel what the experience is, and then be able to bring that to a level of seeing what the meaning is often, like I'm writing in there about Henry Hsu's philosophy book, dense book on basic rights and what do rights mean. So I'm trying to go from microscope to telescope and back. That hopefully holds up. But yeah, when it starts to feel like you know how to, the structure and what's going to come, that there is a predictability to it, then that's a bummer. And I think that's what's great about Michael Lewis is that he's always giving you the people that matter and what their story is, but he is finding ways to get better and better at illuminating their character, seeing, you know, the interlocking complexities that govern their lives, and make that happen. And that's where it, that's where I think the reason an Alexana, Svetlana Alexievich is so amazing is she is you reach a point where journalism starts to be not just the interlocking mechanisms, but then how people and their personalities and their behaviors go into it. Robert Caro, I saw at the New Yorker Festival, and he's another person where, you know, really understanding what drives Lyndon Johnson and then what constrains Lyndon Johnson and what are the forces in the world. And that is, that's when it starts to cross the line and start to become literature and you're starting to see these deeper things happening. And that's, I don't get to do that by any means in any piece, but I'm striving for it as far as I can in some of them.
So I think we'll close with a lightning round.
Okay.
One minute question and answer from listeners. And we'll start with this one, written in by Valerie Lewis and Howard Foreman with similar questions. Why do you continue to operate, especially given the arguments that you can't be your best as a doctor if you're splitting your time?
There are lots and lots of reasons. One is that in order to operate, I've had to narrow down what I do. So I loved doing general surgery and taking care of really sick people and doing emergencies. I don't do emergencies. Now I do almost exclusively cancer surgery, which is not emergencies. And then even there, it's a handful of operations that I've done thousands of. So that allows me to keep doing it. And then I want to keep doing it because every time I think I understand the world, how the world works, I meet another patient. And everything you understand has upended. Plus, I see all the forces happening. You know, I'm seeing patients now who have $3,000 and $4,000 deductibles. I did not see that 10 years ago. I know what it's like to go from no from 10% uninsured to no uninsured. I see how transgender plays out, and you start seeing people feel comfortable being transgender in my office in a way that I never saw before. So, you know, you see the world, and I fear not having access to that world. And then I struggle with that world, like getting paid and dealing with, you know, our faculty meetings where we're not all on the same page and, you know, like all that crap, which we all have to go through, and it's all over the reality of the world. So,
but the value still exceeds all the crap and frustrations of being part of the medical community.
And then I get the final part of it is a day in surgery, and I can have four operations. I know I got something done. And then in my writing work, it's 6 months, and I don't know whether it's going to be any good or not. And then in our public health work, it's usually 3 to 5 year long projects or longer, and you don't know how they're going to come out at all. So my least stressful, most assuredly gratifying day of the week is the day I'm doing surgery.
Question from the Iowa Hospital Association. What do we really need more of? Doctors, nurses, social workers, none of the above? Maybe hospital administrators?
None of the above. I think the big transformation we're undergoing is from a health system that has paid, rewarded, and hired people to be cowboys, to be autonomous individuals plying their craft, to one where none of us have the entirety of care. We now all have just a piece of care, and we're trying to become pit crews. And we are not... We're not trained to be a member of a pit crew. We're not hired that way, not rewarded that way. And so it's less about, do we need more doctors, more nurses? We need more team members. We need more people who know how to work collectively as a group. And all of my work on the public health side, like we talked about Checklist Manifesto, that was just a checklist that enables a team to say, have we cohered as a team so we have the same mental view of what the goals of the operation are, what the condition of the patient is, what we're going to accomplish today, and rolling it out in 8 cities, it cut death 47%. We've now rolled it out through most operations in the world. We cut deaths across South Carolina hospitals 22%, for the country of Scotland 27%, and France 35%, and in low-income settings 60%. So that's just about teams being able to be the pit crew rather than the cowboys.
This one's a bit of a change up from a Twitter user named Fairness. What is your perspective on an afterlife?
Well, I'm someone who does not think there is an afterlife for me. My wife completely disagrees. And so my perspective is that I think that I love the world and I get to be part of the world. And the meaning for me of my existence comes from whether I'm part of that chain of being, which continues onward after me. If the world blew up, and if we went to war with North Korea and everything blew up with what matters to me in it.
It's unfortunate that you're in Washington, D.C. right now. We really would be safer up in Boston, Massachusetts.
I do not think I have an afterlife to look forward to.
Question from someone named Pick Swapuskis. Ask him if he trusts the process. I think this is an allusion to the Philadelphia 76ers general manager when he resigned, cited your work. Do you know that reference?
I do.
You've been, I mean, there's a good question there, though. You've been cited by an NBA executive, Rivers Cuomo, your friend. I think you mentioned you in the liner notes. Who has been the most unusual person to draw on your work and bring it into his or her world?
I have no, well, I mean, I've seen, you know, nuclear power industry take up some of the I do trust in the process. And to me, the process is you put these ideas out in the world, and then it's fascinating. I mean, it's like watching a child go out in the world, and you get these reports back about how great he's doing. And you know, you're just incredibly proud of him. But at the same time, you're like, all right, well, that was then, this is now. What am I going to do next? How do I live up to expectation and just put all of that away and just find the next thing to do?
Carolyn Mullen wants to know, why does public health lose out in healthcare debates? I think she's alluding to the cut to the Public Health Prevention Fund, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I wrote an article called Slow Ideas about why some things spread, some ideas go viral and other ones don't. And the ideas that do not spread are the ones that do spread are ones that are have an immediate and visible effect and are good for not only the public, but the people who have to implement it. And the ones that don't spread are the things that are invisible, have an invisible effect, invisible and delayed effect, and are painful for the people who have to implement. So global warming is sort of the extreme example, right? Anything that we need to do about it right now involves making choices about something that is having harmful effects now, but it's really it's what happens years from now that's really hard. And in order to do something about it, we have to take pain now for gain later. Boy, that's a loser. And public health is that by definition, right? It's infections and it's high blood pressure and it's diabetes. It's things that don't make you feel bad now, but if you act on it, you save huge numbers of lives with time. And because of the way we're wired, we love immediate visible effects where there's no pain for me in order to have the gain for everybody. And that's not how it works.
A question from a Twitter user, I'm skewering the name, Sue J. Is organized medicine help or is organized religion a help or a hindrance in medicine?
Yes. I sort of have the same answer about technology. They amplify our values. So organized religion and technology are only as good as our values. And so when organized religion is in betrayal of basic values of and I'll go back to what I said before, is do all lives have equal worth and dignity? And are we upholding that idea? When we are not, technology and organized religion are very dangerous. And when they are, they're very powerful and can be essential to getting where we want to go.
Last question from Robin Seltzer. What would be the one book you would assign to pre-med students?
The immediate one that jumped to mind was Moneyball.
You really love Michael Lewis.
I love Michael Lewis. Moneyball because I make my lab read it because it was the simple matter of sort of recognizing that what you think is an art, scouting to pick baseball players, and individual, it's my craft how to make that happen. could produce better results by recognizing that if you measure and examine and look more closely, it's not that it spits out the answer, but that it gives you things you have to grapple with, information that you need to see. And the variation is much more interesting than the averages or what you think is what you can see. And so, that perspective that when you go into a hospital or a clinic as a medical student or a nurse or a PA or anybody in that world, and you think you see what is the norm, this is the way this is, you got to understand you are seeing just one slice of an incredible variation. I met the guy who is the chief innovation officer for CVS, the head of the pharmacy innovation. And CVS is now a Fortune 10 company, and they used to only promote pharmacists to be their leaders. But when you've gotten so big, you can't just have pharmacists. So their head of pharmacy innovation is a lawyer. A Yale lawyer who came in, and his first assignment was to change the electronic information system, which meant reworking the whole workflow, the whole way pharmacists do their job. Like, how the heck do you take that job on and not get fired within 6 months when you're not even a pharmacist? Like, you don't know what they do. And he said the way he went about it was by that he measured. He went in and spent a day at 40 different pharmacies and collected all kinds of data, and then created a deck that he lived on for the next 2 years, a PowerPoint deck. And when a pharmacist would say, well, you don't understand, you're not a pharmacist, this is the way we do things. And he'd say, you're right, I don't understand what you do, but I do know more about what you all do. And what you're saying you do is only what 10% of you do. Here's what the best 10% of you do. So how about that? And that was incredibly powerful. An outsider could come in and reshape clinical care in ways that, led to lots of patients having higher rates of adherence because they got their refills, and, basic things like you could get the pharmacist to be part of a workflow that could dispense vaccines now and, make changes that are pretty interesting. So there's my one book. Go to Moneyball.
Your one book and the accompanying analysis. And Dr. Atul Gawande, I don't know where this fits on your weekly dashboard of how you spent your time, but I'm glad you spent it with us. Thank you for the podcast.
Thank you.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to Dr. Atul Gawande and to our producer, Bridget Mulcahy. You can find me at ddiamondatpolitico.com. You can find Pulse Check on your favorite podcast player, and you can find a new episode of the podcast next week.